listening to the North Carolina Reading Service, broadcasting from Raleigh, North Carolina, serving the blind and print-impaired community since 1983. This is Nancy Jones. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from Vanity Fair magazine. This is Vanity Fair Part B. Here's the continuation of The Overlord's Underdog by Tom Doughton. Combat never got made. Saving Private Ryan was greenlit around the same time, sinking the competing World War II project, but Toborov's career as a producer, copyright attorney was born. He developed a system. He tracked the rights of old TV shows and films from eras when creators often retained rights. He'd cold call the writers of properties like My Favorite Martian or track down their heirs. He'd offer to examine their contracts looking for angles. When he found an inn, he'd pitch revival projects around town and, when a studio said yes, take a cut. In Hollywood, no one had really done what he had done with copyright law. Multiple agents and producers agree. Sometimes writers would come to him. In 2004, he got a call from Guy Waldron, creator of The Dukes of Hazzard, after Warner Brothers announced it was going to make it into a movie starring Jessica Simpson. The studio assumed they had the rights sewn up. Toborov discovered that before it was a series, it had been a movie called Moonrunners, which he argued gave Waldron part of the rights. Toborov asked them to settle for $1.25 million, but they waved him away and went ahead with production. He sued and got a judge to take the almost unheard-of action of issuing a preliminary injunction ahead of the release. Faced with the possibility of federal marshals seizing film canisters, Warner Brothers agreed to settle. He told the studio's general counsel his number, "I want Tu Chai," which either means "I want your two firstborn children," or it means 36. In Hebrew numerology, Chai means life and equals 18, so Tu Chai by his math is $36 million. Warner Brothers reportedly settled for $17.5 million, or just about one Chai. The first line of Variety was, "Chalk one up for the little guy," Toborov says. That case made me known at all the studios. He's gotten involved in even more entangled pieces of IP, including working with the descendants of the creators of Superman, Jerry Siegel and Joe Shuster. The two had created the character as teenagers, but parted with the rights in 1938. When they tried in court to reclaim them in 1947, they lost. They lived their lives in the shadow of Superman, Toborov says. The daughter described how they used to eat Spam for dinner and didn't partake in any of the profits. Everybody else became filthy rich. Toborov took on the case in the early 2000s and won back Siegel's half of the Superman copyright for his family. Warner Brothers countersued Toborov personally, claiming he stood to gain as a financial participant in the Superman copyright. That case was dismissed, but the litigation between the Shuster heirs and the studio is ongoing. He's also worked for the family of Jack Kirby, one of the key early artists for Marvel Comics. After losing rulings in lower courts, Toborov petitioned the Supreme Court, which he says was on the verge of taking on a case that would have re-examined work for hire under the Copyright Act of 1909. Disney settled for an undisclosed amount in 2014. That obsessiveness has become his defining trait. He's literally the Rockford Files. This guy sitting out there in Malibu, says Stuart Manishill, a talent manager and producer who's worked with Toborov on projects like an upcoming remake of 1988's cult classic martial arts film Bloodsport, an adaptation of the book the 1987 psychological thriller Angel Heart was based on, and a TV series, Crystal Lake, based on the Friday the 13th movies. He's not in a trailer, but he's in an office, and it's him and an assistant, and he'll just keep going. When I originally started doing this with IP in Hollywood, it was like, "Toborov, you're a bottom feeder. And I would say, yeah, I'll see you down there, he says, adding that he has a full team working for him. Things changed as the streaming era took off and companies loaded up on well-known properties. His ability to untangle the rights for content, allowing it to be made, became a valuable currency. Producers and writers increasingly viewed Toberoff as a resource in a complicated legal landscape. When he started doing it, it was like total outsider, says Manishiel. I think that more and more places now see the value in dealing with him, evidenced by the number of deals he has. They need the IP. Or, as Toberoff puts it, it went from bottom feeder to Toberoff player. What do you got? Let's make a deal. A few years ago, he secured the U.S. rights to 1988's Beetlejuice for one of the film's living co-writers and the estate of the other. He then reached out to Mike Simpson, agent for director Tim Burton. Burton, who'd been waffling for years on whether to make a sequel, agreed to do it, followed by original cast members, including Michael Keaton, Winona Ryder, and Catherine O'Hara. Beetlejuice 2024 made more than $400 million at the box office, with Toberoff credited as a producer. It drives these studios crazy. They just can't believe that there's this guy out there that can actually impact them that much. Simpson says, from the artist's point of view, he's a godsend. To the studios, he's something else entirely. Terrorist, one executive suggests. Toberoff's maximalist negotiating style makes working with him impossible, multiple executives say. Despite Toberoff having clients who control desirable properties like A Nightmare on Elm Street, some would rather not make a movie than work with him. Sometimes, when a studio wants to remake an old movie or TV show, and the business affairs team discovers his name attached to one of the parties, the train screeches to a halt. In many places, it dies right there, one executive explains. Phone conversation over, pursuit of it over. Few from the studios would go on the record discussing Toberoff. As one put it, life's too short. They say their frustration isn't about paying rights holders. Studios expect that. What galls them is Toberoff's tooth-and-nail negotiations and his insistence on becoming a producer himself, complete with credit and fees. It's not the first time we've seen this kind of desire for people who really want to be in show business, one executive says. It's their way in. Manishiel sees the studio resistance differently. As Hollywood's traditional power structure has weakened, he argues, Toberoff's leverage has only grown. The pushback, he believes, stems from executives' anxiety about their diminishing control and having to pay the creators for whom Toberoff is getting the rights. Everybody in Hollywood's insecure. As a studio exec, a huge part of the job is to exploit the library of IP. And then there's Mark, who can stand in the way. Of course they're not going to like that. Still, even Manishiel admits Toberoff can be exhausting. He has that litigator thing where everything is a fight, and sometimes you're like, dude, let's just take the deal. But he's proven me wrong on multiple occasions and gotten better terms. Toberoff shrugs at the studio backlash. When they have rights, they exploit every inch of those rights, and even sue each other over those rights, he says. So it's all about whose rice bowl is getting pissed in. Emmanuel was more emphatic about studio complaints over Toberoff's demand to be a producer. There's a lot of effing producers that don't deserve credit. Who gives a shit? In early 2024, Toberoff got a call from Emmanuel. It was about Elon Musk. Emmanuel had been friends with the Tesla CEO for more than 15 years, since buying an early Roadster. I just don't like driving a Prius, he says. In February, Musk filed a lawsuit against Altman and OpenAI through the firm Irrell and Manella, citing breach of contract. One Saturday, he called Emmanuel while the agent was at the Riviera Country Club in the Pacific Palisades, and the two chatted about the case. Musk wanted a second opinion, and Emmanuel told him to bring Toberoff on. He looks at things differently than other lawyers, Emmanuel says. When you're not billing hourly, you get really creative about how to think about the law. Refiled with Toberoff running legal strategy, the lawsuit now frames the OpenAI story as a shared vision-turned-secret betrayal. In 2015, Altman pitched Musk on creating OpenAI as a nonprofit Manhattan project for AI to counter Google's dominance. Musk, who'd been publicly warning about AI as an existential threat to humanity, agreed to fund it. He contributed more than $44 million over 5 years and recruited key talent, including its chief scientist, Ilya Sutskever, the lawsuit says. By 2017, Altman and co-founder Greg Brockman had suggested converting to a for-profit to raise outside money. Musk refused. "Either go do something on your own or continue with OpenAI as a nonprofit," he wrote to them, according to the lawsuit. "I will no longer fund OpenAI until you have made a firm commitment to stay, or I'm just being a fool who is essentially providing free funding to a startup." Altman reassured him they remained enthusiastic about the nonprofit structure. But in 2019, they created a for-profit arm with Altman as CEO and raised $1 billion from Microsoft. In the succeeding years, OpenAI would raise billions of dollars, release ChatGPT, raise tens of billions more, fire and then reinstate Altman over 5 days, redo the board with members that were allied with the CEO, and reach a $500 billion valuation. Meanwhile, Musk launched a competitive AI firm called xAI, but his feelings over the fallout with Altman nagged at him. The core of his allegation is that the CEO built a company, ostensibly as a nonprofit, with his money, and then conspired against him with Brockman by turning it into a for-profit for their personal gain. Key to their argument are personal files that Brockman kept, where he jotted down his private thoughts about Musk, the company, and the nonprofit conversion. They were obtained as part of legal discovery. "Okay, so what do I really want?" Brockman writes in one entry, according to court documents, mulling over his goals and potential for the company. Later, he adds, "This is the only chance we have to get out from Elon. Is he the glorious leader that I would pick? We truly have a chance to make this happen. Financially, what will take me to $1 billion? In another note, "Cannot say that we are committed to the nonprofit. Don't want to say that we're committed. If 3 months later we're doing B Corp, then it was a lie." Toberoff, who calls the files Brockman's diary, says they are basically a confessional as to everything we're saying. OpenAI's version is that Altman, Brockman, and Musk all agreed that the company needed a for-profit structure, with Musk even suggesting they attach Tesla to the company as its cash cow, according to an OpenAI legal filing. When that plan fell through, Musk stormed out, not over the nonprofit issue, OpenAI argues, but because he believed its chance of reaching superintelligence was zero. "OpenAI is on a path of certain failure relative to Google," Musk wrote in an email in January 2018, a part of the court documents. "There obviously needs to be immediate and dramatic action, or everyone except for Google will be consigned to irrelevance." He resigned from the board a month later. In March 2019, OpenAI created its capped profit subsidiary. The company's legal rebuttal says Toberoff's case cherry-picks key information, leaving out important context showing that Musk was aware of and endorsed a conversion. The rest is just bitterness on the Tesla founder's part, since the company became a rocket ship without him. Altman has laid out his response on X. "I helped turn the thing you left for dead into what should be the largest nonprofit ever. You know as well as anyone a structure like what OpenAI has now is required to make that happen." Privately, the two tried to mend fences for a time. In a February 2023 email revealed during discovery, Altman pleaded with Musk to stop attacking the company. "I remember seeing you in a TV interview a long time ago, maybe 60 Minutes, where you're being attacked by some guys, and you said they were heroes of yours, and it was really tough. Well, you're my hero, and that's what it feels like when you attack OpenAI. Musk responded, I hear you, and it is certainly not my intention to be hurtful, for which I apologize, but the fate of civilization is at stake. Toberov says he was drawn to the case partly on moral grounds that Altman really had defrauded a charity. He also was concerned about the existential threat of AI, but he admits he wanted to be closer to the AI world as the technology swept through Hollywood. Then, of course, there was the drama. They say Hollywood is like high school with money, and I quickly realized that Silicon Valley is like high school with a lot more money, Toberov says. He describes himself as coming from an ultra-liberal background, which would put him at odds with Musk politically. But during a visit to Tesla's headquarters, he saw a different side of the man, surrounded by his company's Optimus robots. These robots would be pacing the halls, and you would stop and talk to them, and they talk to you because they are connected to AI, Toberov says. That's where he belongs in that world. That's where he excels. He was just bouncing around. Since taking over, the lawyer has thrown everything at stopping OpenAI's attempt to restructure into a for-profit entity. He's worked hard at spinning the press. He told Reuters that while the case Musk's original legal team had filed was a goldfish, this federal suit was a great white. In January 2025, Toberov called me while I was at the Wall Street Journal, having read a story I co-wrote about Altman's increasing conflicts as an investor and his role at OpenAI. Talking to Toberov in this period was chaotic. On calls, I would hear the ringtone from Signal, the secure messaging app popular with reporters, going off endlessly in the background. He once sent me a text that was probably intended for a New York Times reporter, then immediately followed up with ignore that last message. When I'm in these lawsuits, I'm at my desk at 9 o'clock, and I have dinner at 9:30 p.m. And I probably would have dinner later if my wife didn't keep calling me, Toberov later said for this story. As with his Hollywood work, he tried to wrest back control of the process with a close reading of the law. Last February, he submitted yet another letter, this one to the Attorneys General of California and Delaware, which governs nonprofits in their state, saying they have a duty to ensure that if a company is converting to a for-profit, the charity's assets are priced at fair market value. They didn't respond, he says. A few weeks later, Toberov tried to force a determination of that value by bidding on it. XAI announced it was submitting a $97.4 billion bid to buy OpenAI that was backed by Musk along with several other investors, including Valor Equity Partners, Emmanuel, and other frequent partners in his financial adventurism. Altman rejected the offer in a post on X. No, thank you, but we will buy Twitter for $9.74 billion if you want. Musk, replying to another commenter, called him Scam Altman. In May, OpenAI changed tax. It announced it was no longer going to convert the entire company into a for-profit entity, but instead just transition its for-profit arm into a public benefit corporation. That could still allow them to give investors equity and potentially go public. The company insists it had nothing to do with Toberov's tactics. Mr. Musk's fake bid did not factor into the company's plans whatsoever, Savitt says. In October, the campaign to stop the restructuring was dealt a blow when the attorneys general in California, where OpenAI is headquartered, and in Delaware, where it's incorporated, approved its new structure. Some nonprofit groups have planned ballot initiatives in California that would undo the AG's decision. The battle lines seem to be forming along industry and geography. Altman has gotten overwhelming support and sympathy from the tech industry, says one person close to OpenAI. OpenAI and Vanity Fair publisher Condé Nast have a multi-year contract that will allow the former to use the latter's content. Most of LA world is super Elon-pilled, this person says. These guys just do whatever Elon wants. OpenAI has tried multiple times to have the suit dismissed. In January, federal judge Ivan Gonzalez-Rogers, an Obama appointee with a pro-consumer record, denied OpenAI's latest motion to dismiss and sent the case to trial. Opening arguments begin in late April in Oakland. Toberoff was jubilant after the decision. "We kicked ass today," he messaged me. The next day, he sent me a link to a CNBC video clip where David Faber discussed the win for Musk team. In it, Faber read a triumphant statement from Toberoff that the hearing had confirmed their claims about Altman's character. "Now their false faces must hide what their false hearts doth know," Faber read on the air. Once again, Toberoff couldn't resist the Shakespeare, though he seemed in on the joke this time. "It's Saturday Night Live," he messaged me. Nonprofit experts are mixed on the case. He seems to be arguing that the failure to advance the nonprofit purpose is a failure to him rather than a failure to the public, says Jill Horwitz, a law professor at Northwestern who's following the case closely. "If OpenAI isn't advancing its nonprofit purpose, that's a harm to the public, not to Elon Musk." The preferred outcome, Toberoff says, would be for the court to force OpenAI to remain a true nonprofit, a result that would effectively unwind its corporate structure and jeopardize tens of billions in investor funding. Failing that, they're seeking disgorgement of wrongful gains that reflect what his stake should be worth. Given he was OpenAI's co-founder and primary original investor. Based on their expert analysis, that comes to as much as $134 billion from OpenAI and Microsoft combined, according to their filing. It would be one of the largest damage awards in legal history, roughly 7,400 chai. The money obviously doesn't matter too much to the richest men in the world. The real victory might be the trial itself, where Musk, along with Altman, Brockman, Microsoft CEO Satya Nadella, and others, will testify about the origins of this company and the question at the heart of Toberoff's complaint, altruism versus greed, and whether the two can ever truly be separated. Next photo, Tech Attack. Elon Musk and Sam Altman in conversation with New York Times columnist Andrew Ross Sorkin at the Vanity Fair New Establishment Summit in 2016. A few days after the judge's ruling, Toberoff calls me. The high from the OpenAI victory has subsided, and instead he is in a righteous fury about another case he is working on, a Hollywood one. He's been representing Sean Gray, a young screenwriter who says he did uncredited work writing action scenes for Top Gun Maverick, working with his cousin, one of the movie's co-writers. Initially, Gray was only seeking credit from Paramount. When Toberoff took the case, he sued for a share of the profits. But they just suffered a huge blow. A federal judge had dismissed Gray's copyright claims entirely, ruling his scenes were derivative works based on Paramount's IP. Worse, Paramount's fraud and copyright infringement counterclaims, alleging Gray deliberately hid his participation, which Gray denies, were greenlit for trial. By countersuing, Paramount was pressuring them to drop the case entirely. There was little for him to gain financially, and with the Musk case now ramping up and billions at stake, he had no time. "They're counting on me just folding. That can never happen," Toberoff says. "I can't bend to this kind of thing. It's literally disgusting." So he'll appeal his case while defending against Paramount's countersuit, which means he'll go to trial against the studio while he's deep in preparations for the Musk case. He said it's against the advice of his friends and family. "Every case I've had has to do with upholding the rights of creators. The fact that I make a good living at it, that doesn't mean that I'm still not doing that, because I am doing that." The contradiction, if there is one, Toberoff is never really explained. Maybe there's nothing to explain. Maybe he's already won. Shooting star. Since joining the New York Knicks in 2022, Jalen Brunson has been the quiet force behind the team's renaissance, transforming them from a franchise that was synonymous with disappointment and incompetence to one that has the potential to bring home the city's first NBA championship since the 70s. Tom Clute speaks to New York's most beloved athlete about his rise from role player to rock star and whether the Knicks can really win it all this year. Photographs by Quentin DeBry. Opening photo shows Brunson at home holding a basketball. Jalen Brunson sips his chamomile tea and ponders a question that still feels strange to ask. Are the New York Knicks good enough to win it all? Brunson, the team's captain and unquestioned star, does not exactly sound like someone planning a ticker tape parade. We got a lot of work to do, he says, his voice taking on the stern register of a concerned parent. Brunson speaks carefully, as if weighing how candid to be. He mentions the Knicks' uneven record, road record, and laments a lack of sharpness on the margins. Then he pauses, collects his thoughts, and offers what feels like a sobering assessment of a team that at the time sits only a few games out of first place. "We're very gifted, we're very talented," Brunson says, "but we need the little things that help us be better, the intangibles. We got to that point last year where we had it. We don't have it right now." Brunson lives by an unforgiving standard, one that propelled his rise and reset expectations for what he and the Knicks can achieve. Currently in his fourth season with the team, Brunson stands as the city's most beloved athlete of the moment. Both the Post and the Times, in rare bipartisan alignment, have anointed him the King of New York, while his number 11 jersey has become a kind of civic uniform across the five boroughs. Fans of all ages swarm for autographs and selfies, or maybe just to say thanks, whenever he braves the hordes of Manhattan. He even garnered 27 write-in votes in last year's mayoral election, 29 if you include the ballots that misspelled his name, and earned a shout-out in Zoran Mamdani's inauguration speech. In a city full of naysayers, Brunson somehow appears to have none at all. "He's been the perfect guy to come to New York," says Ben Stiller, a lifelong Knicks fan. "That sentiment has more to do with substance than showmanship. The Jalen Brunson experience is not characterized by flash, and he has achieved rock star status without ever acting like one. A crafty southpaw, Brunson has an old man game, one built on deft footwork, a soft touch around the basket, pump fakes, and post-ups. He is a prolific scorer, but his highlight reel is perhaps not quite as scintillating as one featuring, say, Anthony Edwards. Brunson's playing style, all efficiency and economy, mirrors his understated demeanor. His father once quipped that his son is boring as shit to interview. His low-key vibe may seem off-brand for a New York icon, but Brunson's improbable journey to stardom and workmanlike approach have endeared him to the city like few others. He's always been an underdog, Stiller says. New Yorkers love that. Most of all, though, they love Brunson for the central role he's played in the Knicks' renaissance, transforming the team from a byword for dysfunction into one typified by competence. He has completely changed the perception and direction of a single franchise, and he's done it in New York, which is not easy to do, says Mike Breen, the longtime ESPN play-by-play announcer and voice of Knicks broadcast. "He's in the conversation to be one of the greatest Knicks of all time, and he's done it in 3+ years. Mamdani, with signature rhetorical flourish, describes Brunson as every New Yorker who's been told that they are not enough, but has proven that the greatness of this city belongs to all of us. Jalen Brunson was never supposed to be a superstar, and that's what makes him ours," Mamdani adds. "He found in New York a place he could call home and came to match the greatness of the city he wears across his chest. He is one of us." The sun shines brighter over Madison Square Garden these days, especially during the playoffs, when long-dormant expectation creeps back in. Those moments have a way of revealing players, and Brunson has won over fans by routinely rising to them, a quality that gives him an edge in the local hierarchy over Aaron Judge, the Herculean Yankees slugger, with an unfortunate habit of saving his worst performances for October. Judge, for what it's worth, received just 11 write-in votes for mayor. Last season, Brunson was named the NBA's Clutch Player of the Year, which he later backed up with a smooth game-winning three to eliminate the Detroit Pistons in the first round of the playoffs. Stiller, like a true diehard, still revisits that play from time to time. "There's something about the guy that has affected more than just winning," says Stiller. "His personality, his story, his work ethic, all of that is so perfectly New York." Having the Knicks back in contention feels just as right. New York, home of Rucker Park, proving ground for Kareem, point guard Holy Land, is a basketball town and one of the sport's true capitals. Brunson has restored that patrimony, bringing the roar back to the Garden in April and May. After winning just one playoff series in the two decades before his arrival, the Knicks have advanced past the first round in each of the last three. Last year, Brunson took them further than they've been in a quarter century, reaching the conference finals for the first time since Bill Clinton was president. When the Knicks go on a run like that, New York feels smaller, shrinking from a sprawling metropolis to a college town where everyone wears the same colors and spills onto the streets after a home win. The fans were so hungry for somebody to lead them out of the darkness and to have some sort of success after so many rough years, says Breen. Here comes this kid, and he provides that. But the happy-to-be-there vibes have given way to loftier expectations. Their appetite for postseason basketball now satisfied, the Knicks faithful have grown peckish for more. The team entered this season with its strongest roster since the 90s, when Pat Riley prowled the sideline and Patrick Ewing manned the paint. Fans who have known little more than disappointment are now indulging dreams of seeing the Knicks win their first championship since 1973. That optimism extends to the top of the organization. In January, owner James Dolan laid down his marker, saying in a local radio interview that the team absolutely has to reach the finals this year. Brunson, carrying the gaze and hopes of an entire city, understands the assignment. We're definitely in win-now mode, he says. Our front office has put a lot into this organization, and it's our team. They're basically saying it's win-now mode, so we got to do our best to win now. Next photo, Great Expectations, shows a basketball court with Brunson in the foreground pointing to the goal, his hand raised in a number one salute. Jalen Brunson received the message from fans and the front office, it's time to win now. The team beat the Orlando Magic and then the San Antonio Spurs to win the in-season NBA Cup in December. I meet Brunson at the Roaster Cafe, a cozy Turkish-inspired spot near his home in the Tony Westchester suburbs. He and his wife, Allie, are regulars, though they usually stop in during quieter hours. On the Saturday after Thanksgiving, the cafe hums with brunchgoers who greet Brunson with nods and knowing smiles as he makes his way to a table beneath a flat screen that displays a crackling holiday fireplace. You're a hell of a player, a man says in passing. Standing at 6'2" with a low, compact build, Brunson arrives in a weekend uniform, sky blue Nike hoodie with Ray-Bans dangling from the collar, black sweatpants, and a matching beanie pulled low over his rounded head. Even with generational wealth and a place on the city's A-list, the 29-year-old Brunson insists convincingly that he has not shed the no-frills mantle of an everyman. It's not like my lifestyle is different, he says. You see where I came to meet you. I'm a regular guy who goes to a local coffee shop to grab tea or coffee or whatever. It doesn't change the way I live. As he speaks, Brunson glances briefly at his phone. He has missed a call from Josh Hart, his former college teammate and closest friend on the Knicks. Off the court, the two host a podcast, Roommates Show, a fairly standard athlete-led gab fest featuring interviews with teammates, coaches, and other NBA figures. Brunson guesses the call was about a planned double date with their wives. You would think we'd get tired of each other, Brunson says. Our wives will be like, you guys just saw each other, and we're like, yeah, and? On their podcast and in post-game press conferences, they sometimes resemble a buddy cop duo, with Brunson typically playing the role of exasperated straight man. I'm kind of the more unfiltered guy and will just say what I think, Hart says. He's a little more political. Brunson's mother, Sandra, puts it a bit differently. Jalen and I are alike in the sense that we are very methodical and intentional, she says. We think things through before we react. There is something wholesome about Brunson's existence, his orbit populated by family and longtime friends. He and Allie, who gave birth to their daughter, Jordan, in July 2024, were high school sweethearts in Greater Chicago. His father, Rick, a former NBA journeyman, is now one of his Knicks coaches, while Sandra serves as chief financial officer of his foundation. Even his professional team is anchored by Day Ones, his younger sister, Erica, and his best friend since eighth grade, Connor Keshaw, handle his marketing responsibilities. "If you are in our circle, Jalen will have your back no matter what," says Allie, a physical therapist with her own practice. "He puts family first. He is intense that way." Brunson says his crew keeps him humble and level-headed, never too high or too low. "Someone like Keshaw," he notes, "won't just say yes or say the things I want to hear." Few keep him more grounded than his dad, and if working with a parent sounds like torture, well, sorry, Brunson can't relate. "He holds me accountable every single day, even when I don't want to be talked to. At the time, I hate it. I'll say something back," Brunson says, "but he's right, and I listen to him. It's the best thing for me. I know when he's being a dad, and I know when he's being a coach." Rick had never coached his son on an official basis before joining the Knicks staff, but Jalen's childhood revolved around intense training sessions with his old man. A video that went viral a few years ago offered a glimpse into what that was like. In a scene straight out of He Got Game, the clip shows a young, increasingly exhausted Jalen performing a series of grueling drills, while Rick, off-camera, gruffly demands more effort. "Everything you do has to be legit," the elder Brunson says at one point in the video. "He was very tough," Jalen says, "but he would ask me all the time, 'Is this what you want to do for a living?' And the answer was always yes. I wasn't being forced to play basketball. He knew this is what I wanted to do. He played in the NBA, so he had the blueprint for what it takes." Rick played for 8 different teams across his 9-year NBA career, including 2 stints with the Knicks between 1999 and 2001. That era, highlighted by the franchise's last appearance in the NBA Finals, is memorialized with photos of a toddler-aged Jalen sporting Knicks gear and posing on the garden hardwood. The early immersion in the league environment had an osmosis-like effect on Jalen, as it often does for an athlete's kid. But it was the exposure to his father's grind that left the deepest impression. For Rick, minutes were scarce, and a roster spot never guaranteed. Mere survival in the NBA hinged on out-hustling his competition. "I think it got so deep in his brain, like, damn, I have to work that hard just to achieve my dream," says Rick, and it just stuck with him. That work ethic and intensity were immediately apparent to Jay Wright, Brunson's coach at Villanova. On a recruiting visit during Brunson's senior year of high school, Wright was left speechless when he saw the young prospect's bedroom walls adorned with quotes from the likes of Aristotle and Marcus Aurelius, along with newspaper clippings of games he lost. "I was blown away," Wright says. "He's the perfect balance between his mom and his father. His father had the mental toughness and commitment level on the court, and his mom had the wisdom, the stoicism, the spirituality." On the spectrum of New York sporting legends, Brunson skews more toward Eli than Broadway Joe. He builds with Legos and listens to Justin Bieber. Along the star-studded celebrity row at the Garden, where Stiller, Spike Lee, and Timothy Chalamet are fixtures, Brunson usually scans first for Mariska Hargitay, the star of Law & Order Special Victims Unit, his favorite show. In interviews, his soundbites fall somewhere between measured and monotone. Rick likens his son's interactions with the media to those of Bill Belichick, the legendary football coach and master of the monosyllabic press conference. That's probably a bit harsh, and Brunson's friends and family, including Rick, are quick to push back against the idea that he's dull. Beneath the stone-faced exterior, they say, is someone who is secretly hilarious. "He's not a stick in the mud," says Sandra. "I'll just say that." Brunson is, according to his dad, probably the biggest clown on the team. He has such a stoic face on the court. "You'd think he doesn't enjoy the game or enjoy life," says Rick, "but he's one of the funniest guys." Hart agrees. He's a goof. He plays around nonstop, he says. But when we get on the court, it's a total switch-up. And he goes into more of a killer mentality. Next photo, on point. Brunson plays pool on December 12th at the Wynn Hotel in Las Vegas. Brunson's sense of humor typically takes the form of well-honed deadpan, often aimed at Hart. He showcased that side in December during a post-game interview with the Prime Video studio crew, turning a playful question into a perfectly timed zinger. When asked about his showing in the mayoral election, Brunson didn't miss a beat, roasting his buddy who had recently been robbed of $185,000 worth of jewelry. "If I was mayor, whoever stole Josh's watches in New York City," Brunson said, "I would make sure they walk free." Brunson is no bore, but he is perhaps a bit of a normie. For someone like him, it can be awkward living in a kingdom of admirers. At the cafe, he recalled an encounter after signing with the team when someone asked if he was the Knicks' savior. "I'm like, I'm not a savior in any way, shape, or form," Brunson says. "I'm just going to do my best to contribute to this team and to help them win." In truth, few believed the Knicks were getting a franchise savior when he signed, and even fewer predicted stardom coming out of college. Brunson entered the league in 2018 after a highly decorated career at Villanova. In three seasons, he won two NCAA championships and a string of individual honors, culminating in National Player of the Year recognition. But most analysts projected a more modest NBA career, questioning whether he had the speed and athleticism to thrive in the pros. One scouting report pegged him as a high-end backup. For most of his four seasons with the Dallas Mavericks, who drafted him in the second round, that description fit. There, he became a key part of the supporting cast around Luka Doncic, the Slovenian virtuoso, selected 30 picks before Brunson. "My role in Dallas was different from my role now," he says. "Everyone thinks, oh, he wasn't the same player, he wasn't this. No, my role was different. As a good teammate and leader, you have to understand where you are and your role on the team." Still, Brunson offered hints that he could reach another level. During the 2021-22 season, he emerged as one of the Mavericks' best players, becoming their third leading scorer while securing a starting role. In the playoffs, with Doncic sidelined, Brunson erupted against the Utah Jazz, including a 41-point performance in Game 2. Brunson became a free agent that summer after Dallas failed to sign him to an extension. The Knicks, leaning on personal ties, made no secret of their interest. Weeks before free agency, they hired Rick Brunson as an assistant on Tom Thibodeau's staff, a familiar arrangement for Rick, who had played for and coached under Thibodeau. Other connections were already in place. Knicks president Leon Rose, a former agent at CAA, had long represented the Brunson family, first signing Rick as his inaugural client and later representing Jalen. The bond between the families runs deep. Jalen counts Rose's daughter Brooke among his closest friends, and Rose's son Sam is now part of his cadre of agents. After Jalen was born, while Rick was playing overseas, Rose helped pick up the slack. "He saw me before my dad did," Jalen says. Brunson eventually agreed to a four-year, $104 million deal with New York, driven by a desire to build his own legacy. "At the time of free agency, I was thinking about all the situations," he says. "Could I be comfortable and stay in a role next to a future Hall of Famer or create my own path? I was never afraid to fail. When you're reaching for your dreams, you've got to take leaps, even if it's uncomfortable." The decision left Dallas's front office bristling. Mark Cuban, the former majority owner of the Mavericks, publicly complained that the team never had a real chance to retain Brunson and that talks went south when his father got involved. Brunson disputes that, maintaining that the Mavericks absolutely had an opportunity to keep him. While he and Cuban later cleared the air on Brunson's podcast, tension lingered. The NBA docked the Knicks a second-round draft pick for tampering in their courtship of Brunson, a penalty Cuban says should have been far worse. Brunson, for his part, has moved on. So, too, apparently, has Cuban, who declined to comment further. Ultimately, the Mavericks could have offered Cuban more money but didn't. Even if they had, the Knicks presented him with something else. When the Knicks made an offer to him, I looked at him and told him, "This team is giving you an opportunity," recalls Sandra. "They're saying they believe in you. You can bet on yourself." Brunson's arrival in New York was not widely seen as transformative, with most viewing him as a reliable lieutenant rather than a franchise pillar. Some commentators even argued the Knicks had overpaid. "I was a little bit skeptical of this move," Stiller admits. But Brunson quickly silenced the doubters. He went from 16 points per game in Dallas to 24 in his first year with the Knicks. By season two in New York, he was averaging nearly 29 points per game, shouldering the bulk of the offense and earning all NBA honors. This season, he is putting together a characteristically stellar campaign, earning a starting spot in the All-Star game for the second straight year and affirming his reputation as one of the league's best players. What he's done, Breen says, is one of the all-time transformations. Even some of Brunson's strongest backers admit they didn't expect all that. "I thought that he would be a great point guard to have on a championship-level team with other great players," says Wright, who retired in 2022. "I thought he could be one of three, not one of one." Brunson stepped seamlessly into the role of franchise player, and the Knicks responded accordingly, treating him like one of the league's most firmly entrenched stars, even more so, it turns out, than Doncic was in Dallas. Under Rose, the team has built a roster to highlight Brunson's strengths, most visibly in the acquisition of three of Brunson's former Villanova teammates, Hart, Dante DiVincenzo, and Michael Bridges. The Nova Knicks synced neatly with Brunson's family-first entourage, but the same loyalty that governs his life off the court is in short supply in the NBA. Rose, in particular, has proven willing to make tough, even cutthroat decisions. Just before last season, the Knicks completed a blockbuster trade, sending DiVincenzo and Julius Randle to the Minnesota Timberwolves, along with a 2025 first-round pick, in exchange for Karl-Anthony Towns, a former Rose client. And following its best postseason showing in a generation, the team fired Thibodeau and replaced him with Mike Brown. Both moves were awkward for Brunson. DiVincenzo was a groomsman in his wedding, and he has known Thibodeau since childhood. Brunson says he wasn't consulted on the DiVincenzo trade, though he got a heads up shortly before it went public, which apparently suits him just fine. He maintains a church and state approach to front office decisions, saying it makes him uncomfortable to get involved. "It's not for me to put my 2 cents in on another man's livelihood," Brunson says. "One of my best friends was getting traded, and so I can't sit there and be like, yeah, trade my best friend or trade Julius." The Thibodeau firing, he says, was also tough. "It was just off," Brunson tells me. "It was a weird situation, because there's this person who I've known for so long, who's helped me, and then I see him go. It's sad, but it's the business. Sometimes you've got to leave the personal stuff out of it." Franchise players are rarely kept entirely out of personnel matters, particularly the type the Knicks executed the past 2 years. When I pressed him to elaborate on his level of involvement, Brunson acknowledged that he offers his perspective when asked, but stressed that he leaves his fingerprints off the final decisions. "The front office has the vision, and it's on us as players to go out and do our job. Yes, I'm asked about stuff, but I remove myself from that," he says. "I'll say something, but I'm not going to be incriminating or say this is what you should do. I'll give my pros and cons." While management has built a roster to complement him, Brunson has reciprocated. In 2024, he signed a 4-year, $156.5 million extension, a dizzying sum, yet well short of the five-year, $269 million deal he could have gotten had he waited a year. There were clear reasons he took the bag, as he puts it. Waiting for the bigger contract carried risk, with an injury potentially jeopardizing his payday. I've seen players wait and then get hurt, and then they're at the mercy of the organization, he says. Brunson, ever the pragmatist, preferred not to take that chance. If I'm thinking about playing well to make sure I get paid, that could mess with me, he says. I play best when I have a free mind, and that did that for me. A lot of people say I sacrificed for the team. 100% I sacrificed for the team, but most importantly, I made sure my family and I are taken care of. For now, though, Brunson's hold on the throne remains firm. He finishes his baklava and gathers his things. As he turns toward the front door of the cafe, a young woman stops him and bashfully asks for a photo. She addresses him as Mr. Brunson and says she is from the Bronx. Then, just before they pose for the camera, she speaks for an entire city. You mean so much to New York, she tells him. This program is intended for the blind and print impaired community. I'm Nancy Jones, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service and broadcasting from its studios in Raleigh, North Carolina. Vanity Fair Part A airs via special subchannel receiver on Saturday and Sunday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Daylight Saving Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Vanity Fair Part B airs via special subchannel receiver on Monday and Tuesday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Daylight Saving Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Both parts A and B are available as a podcast at our website, www.ncreadingservice.org. Opening and closing music by Calexico. Interval selection by Mark Hoffman.